We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. A small outsider record label in Cincinnati played an important role in helping to integrate America in the years following World War II. It launched the career of the man who would come to be known as the godfather of soul, James Brown. King also recorded country, blues, rockabilly, gospel, bluegrass, western swing, polka, and comedy. Its diverse roster of artists included the Stanley Brothers, the Delmore Brothers, Wynonie Harris, Ike Turner, and Red Fox. On the program today, the story of King Records. Our guest is John Hartley Fox. He says King Records was the most important record company in the United States in the years between 1945 and 1960. Our guest, John Fox, is the author of King of the Queen City, the story of King Records. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. Our number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. King of the Queen City, the story of King Records, is published by the University of Illinois Press. John Fox, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm fine, Celeste. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. King Records, the most important record company in the U.S. between 1945 and 1960. Why?
I think a few reasons. During that time, primarily I think the first reason would be that King recorded as much and as many different kinds of what's called vernacular American music as any record company did. Like you said in the intro, they recorded virtually every kind of music in the United States at that time, except classical music. They even did some pop. They were not very successful with pop, but they did pop and jazz and all of the styles that you mentioned. So that's one of the reasons that just the sheer mass and diversity of the King catalog during that quarter century was, I think, unmatched by any record company during that time. The second reason that King was so important at that time was Sid Nathan, the owner and founder of King, instituted a lot of business innovations at King that were followed by other independent record companies to a greater or lesser extent, depending on their capital situation. But King pioneered a lot of ideas that other independent labels would really prosper by, primarily Nathan's idea that King should be a self-contained empire where an artist could walk into the King complex in Cincinnati, could walk in there in the morning with an idea for a song and walk out at 5 o'clock that afternoon with an actual finished record under his or her arm and be able to start selling it. And to accomplish that kind of speed and in-house capability, Sid Nathan, as his finances permitted over the years, just added bits to his infrastructure, including an in-house recording studio where he employed a house band, which both of which were kind of firsts for independent labels in that era. He also built a pressing plant to manufacture records there at the Brewster Avenue complex, a printing plant to print all their advertisements and record covers, a shipping and distribution network that encompassed 33 regional branch offices, a trucking fleet to ship records, and even a line of record players to play them on.
Mm.
And obviously, most labels did not ape that whole model, but they took from it what they could use, particularly an in-house recording studio. Labels like Stax and Motown and a lot of other smaller labels, specialty out in Los Angeles, really took that idea and ran with it, had a lot of success with it.
Yeah. Now, you think that King Records played a role in the integration of America. How so?
Well, again, a few ways. Sid Nathan, during the run of King Records, tried to run as much as possible a colorblind operation. Sid always said that he was interested in hiring talent, and the talent could be found in any race, religion, nationality, any group of people. The talent was not the exclusive province of any one group. And that colorblind attitude took a lot of forms. One of the most important was hiring Henry Glover to be a staff producer and essentially second in command for about 10 years there in the middle. Henry was a black man, musician, arranger, songwriter, producer, and he was the first, probably the first post-war black executive at a record company in America, probably only about the second in history, but the first since the war. And one of Henry's significant contributions was that he worked as much with white country artists as he did with the rhythm and blues and jazz and blues artists. He recorded such folks as Homer and Jethro and Grandpa Jones, Moon Mullican, Merle Travis, the Delmore Brothers. And following that example of Glover and other producers working interchangeably with black and white music and musicians, which wasn't done very much at that time, King also had integrated house bands where he would have, say, R&B drummers play on a country record or country guitarists play on a blues record and vice, you know, all the way around, just mixing things up. Sid also crossed those musical barriers between country music and blues and rhythm and blues, the supposed barriers. He crossed them with material as well, having his country artists record blues and R&B songs and having his blues and R&B artists record country songs. And I think basically the role that King played in integration then was sort of stripping away the fallacy that there was a big difference between these kinds of music and their respective audiences, that he found that it was essentially all the same audience, and that the differences between country and blues were really pretty minimal when you got down to it. So I think that by breaking down barriers and by showing that there was, in the record business at least, that there was no negative consequence to breaking down those barriers, I think empowered a lot of labels and a lot of other musicians to take even bigger steps that went into, as we went into the 60s, it really played a big role in integrating society.
Mm. King Records launched James Brown, but the launch was a little rough. You want to tell the story?
Sure. James Brown had been discovered by a traveling record producer and talent scout named Ralph Bass, who ran a King subsidiary label called Federal. Ralph spent a lot of his time traveling around the South looking for musicians to record for Federal. And while he was in Atlanta, he heard a dub of a song that turned out to be called Please, Please, Please by a group called The Flames. He found out they were in Macon, Georgia, So he took an Atlanta disc jockey down there as a sort of a guide. And they went to Macon, Georgia, and made some phone calls and found out that the Flames were managed by a man named Clint Brantley. Ralph went through a bunch of twists and turns that he likened to a James Bond novel, and finally linked up with Clint Brantley, found the Flames, went and heard them that night, and signed them on the spot. He thought they were great. Signed them on the spot, told them to come up to Cincinnati, and he would do a recording session at King for their first four or five songs. So the band was all excited. They come up to Cincinnati, and they get to work on their first song, which was Please, 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 the one that Ralph Bass had heard and been knocked out by. And we're maybe 30, 45 seconds into the recording of it, and suddenly this loud, raucous, raspy voice comes on over the intercom telling them to stop, that, you know, hold everything, that this was the worst piece of junk that Sid Nathan yelling into the intercom,
mm-hmm.
saying this was the worst piece of junk he'd ever heard, and nobody would ever want to listen to this. The man was just saying one song over and over, or one word over and over again, please. And there was kind of a stunned silence, and then Ralph Bass and Sid Nathan joined battle, arguing about it. And finally Ralph said, Ralph had this dub that he had heard and had first become enchanted by. And he'd played that for a bunch of people in Atlanta and down around Macon. And finally he said to Sid Nathan, he said, okay, here's what you do. Go ahead and put this song out in the Atlanta area. And if it's not a hit there, you don't have to fire me. I quit. Ralph was so sure that this was going to be a hit that he staked his career on it. So the record came out, and it was a hit in Atlanta. A regional hit, not a big national hit, but it was enough to launch James Brown's career and save Ralph Bass's career at King.
So the song is Please, 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 and we can listen to it here on the Afternoon Magazine. Please, 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 James Brown.
Please, 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 please.
Please, 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 James Brown, recorded on King Records. And after this rough start, though, James Brown and Nathan became close, and you say shared almost a father-son bond, and Brown stayed with the label for a very long time.
Brown stayed with the label as long as he possibly could, and longer than he really should have. Sid Nathan died in 1968. And James stuck around and made hits for King until, I think, 1970, 71, when he finally was signed by PolyGram Records. And even though he made probably more money at PolyGram than he did at King, he always regretted that. He said that King was his family. And one of his comments was that King was a small label that wanted to have big artists. And PolyGram was a big label that wanted to have small artists.
Mm.
But, yeah, he and Sid Nathan fought probably at least every important release that James Brown put out on the label was preceded by a bitter fight. But, like I said, they had a very close, almost father-son relationship, and when Sid died in 1968, James Brown was one of the pallbearers at his funeral. So they had an odd, it was a love-hate relationship. I don't think that Sid understood what James was trying to do musically, and I don't think that he ever probably appreciated the music, but, you know, he certainly appreciated the fact that James sold millions of records. So.
Yeah. Sid Nathan, what a great businessman.
Yeah, Sid had learned, he owned a used record store in Cincinnati before he got into King Records. And he learned from working at that store a little bit about people's tastes and found that much of the conventional wisdom was not really correct about what kinds of music people listen to and what kinds of records they bought. And those are things that he would put into play later when he had his label. But I think the important thing about Sid as a businessman was he felt that the more of the process that could be brought in-house, the better off the company would be. And he realized that there was always more than one way to solve any given problem. And probably his greatest quality as a businessman was he was a fairly fearless risk taker. He did things that not many business people would have done, certainly not many record companies would have done, in terms of like building a pressing plant, which was a huge capital investment, but it was one that paid off for him. But Sid always believed in just sort of, forging ahead. If you didn't know how something was done, well, you just figure it out or invent a different way. Or, his business knowledge was gained at the retail level. And he was one of the canniest of the independent record company operators at the time, in that he wasn't so concerned about imposing an artistic vision or a sound on the products that came out of King. He hired good people, both people like Ralph Bass and Henry Glover, in the office and in the studio, but he also hired, interesting musicians that his folks thought could do good records. And then he let them do their music with very little control, like James Brown. Sid certainly didn't understand stuff like I Got You, I Feel Good, and Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, and songs like that. He certainly didn't understand that as music, but once the hits started coming in, he trusted James enough to know that James knew what he was doing musically. And that was an attitude that he applied to most of the people on the label. He let them do their music without a lot of interference. And I think that because of that, he attracted a huge array of talent from, every genre of music pretty much across the board was at King for one time or another. And the only real constant during all that time was Sid, so... He was King Records, and his business practices sort of were a one-of-a-kind thing, but they definitely worked for him.
Yeah, and also, though, as you report in King of the Queen City, he identified with those on the margins of society. He was an outsider himself, and he was very much aware of that.
Yeah, he never lost that feeling. In his case... The outsiderness came from being Jewish in a city of like Cincinnati, which they were not unknown there, but it certainly wasn't very much in the cultural mainstream. So he always felt that he was an outsider to proper society, and felt that kind of the mission of King Records was to, well, he often said this, that his goal was to make music for the little man. And, what he meant by the little man was just fans of the kinds of music that a lot of the major record companies weren't doing at the time, like country music and blues and black gospel music and rhythm and blues, and, even down to like party records by Red Fox, things that just weren't being served by the big record companies, Sid was there to do.
You mentioned country, and I'd like to talk next about the Delmore Brothers.
Okay.
King was important for the Delmore Brothers. They had had success at the Grand Ole Opry, but after a five-year run there, their career went into decline. What was the problem, and how did King turn it around?
Well, the problem was on a couple levels. The Delmores just the radio industry at that time. An artist would go to a station and perform on the radio station while performing live personal appearances within the station's listening ship. So eventually, you would kind of play out the area. You'd play it everywhere within the radio listening ship that would have you. So you'd have to move on. Most country artists moved on, you know, every few years. This problem was compounded in the Delmores' case by the fact that both brothers had problems with alcohol and were professionally, I guess you'd say, self-destructive enough that they kind of both wore out their welcome and burned their bridges, no matter how great they were. So when they came to King, they were working at WLW Radio in Cincinnati. When they came to King, they'd already been, they started having hits in the early 30s, and this was the mid-40s, and they had had several ups and downs already in their career, and I think they realized that King was probably their last realistic shot at the big time. So one thing was that they were open to Sid Nathan's suggestions. I think how King turned it around was hooking the Delmore Brothers up with the boogie-woogie craze that had come into country music a couple years earlier in the mid-40s. The early recordings that the Delmore Brothers did on King, say in like 1944, 1945, 1946, were very similar to the kinds of records they had done in the 30s, just acoustic duet material. What Sid Nathan had them start doing was these boogie-themed songs with electric guitar and just sort of a change of pace for them. And giving all credit to the Delmores, Alton and Rabin, they adapted to it great, and they turned out to be just masters of the form and started having huge hits with like Hillbilly Boogie and Freight Train Boogie. And then really hit the jackpot with Blues Stay Away From Me in 1949, which became a country standard. And it definitely put them back on the front burner career-wise. But, you know, oddly enough, even though they just had the biggest record of their career, that radio pattern still persisted. You know, they burned out at WLW and then went still a few more stations, ending up at, I think, WMC in Memphis at the time Rabin Delmore died in 1952, which broke up the act. But, you know, such was the nature of a country musician at that time, and except for the lucky few who landed at the Grand Ole Opry and then were able to stick at the Grand Ole Opry, those folks had it pretty good, but most of the rest of the artists in country music had to lead a very transient life, moving from station to station every two or three years. And so even though the Delmores were back on top record-wise in terms of selling records, that part of their life didn't change.
You suggest that we play Blues Stay Away From Me. Why that tune?
Well, it was the biggest record of the Delmores' career and the biggest country record in 1949. But the reason behind that is this was kind of a spontaneous in-studio creation, a collaboration between Alton and Rabin Delmore, a harmonica player named Wayne Rainey, and Henry Glover, the producer and arranger. Henry came to them with sort of the basic shell of a song, and then the four of them created it in the studio. Another example of, you know, a mixed creative team coming up with a huge hit at King. And I think it was just sort of a shot across the bow to the rest of the industry that King was doing things a different way than other country labels were. I mean, this was a very different, even though Boogie Woogie had taken country music by storm, this was a very different sound in country record in 1949. And the way it was created was also very different, and it was just sort of, I think, very emblematic kind of the way that King did business.
Okay, well, let's listen to this 1949 recording from King Records, Blues Stay Away From Me, the Delmore Brothers. Marvelous. Blues Stay Away From Me. What impact did this have on country western music?
Well, I think it was one of the records that probably pushed the door open a little bit wider to admitting that black music was an important part of country music. And I think it led to, well, you know, it's hard to draw straight line mm-hmm. between things, but I think it encouraged people to embrace that side of their musical upbringing, which virtually every musician in the South, white and black, share the same kind of upbringing. So, you know, most of at least the first two or three generations of country musicians certainly had a pretty significant exposure to black music. Growing up, and I think that it helped, for better or for worse, it helped move country music closer to the pop mainstream. Now, I think that was, compared to a lot of what surrounded it on the radio at the time, Blues Stay Away From Me was a pretty palatable song to a lot of people who didn't like a lot of country music. You know, between the groove and the performance and just the overall feel of the record, I think it appealed to a lot of people who weren't really country fans at the time.
Yeah, it has a really bluesy feel to it.
Oh, yeah, very relaxed blues feel that was just not very present in country music at that time.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is John Hartley Fox. He is the author of King of the Queen City, the story of King Records. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon if you've got a question or a comment. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. The number, the toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 1-800-878-8255. One of the big R&B stars for King Records was Wynonie Harris. And this was very interesting. You quote him as saying, "I knew I had to be different if I was going to make my bread singing the blues." What approach did Harris take that made him stand out?
Well, I think he was one of the first of the post-war blues singers to really try to consciously create and adopt a colorful stage persona, following maybe, say, T-Bone Walker, guitarist down in Texas. So he certainly added a degree of personal flamboyance that was very influential to a lot of musicians. He also felt that he needed to be what he called a very manly man singer, a very aggressive, hard-edged, proto-rock singer. He wanted to do a lot of sexually charged music, you know, double entendre songs for which he was duly famous. And he wanted to, he sensed from being out there on the road, he sensed in the late 40s and early 50s that black and white, especially teenagers, were coming much closer together musically than they ever had been before. You know, he was starting to see some white faces at his shows on the road, and I think was one of the first, you can't really say he was moving towards the rock market because that didn't exist at the time. What he was doing was helping to create rock and roll by stripping, say, the 40s forms of blues singing, mostly had fronted larger bands, and he wanted to put the emphasis solely on the singer and the song with a much smaller backing band, what would become, you know, sort of the prototypical rock band, a 4 or 5 6 piece backing band. And then he very, very consciously started trying to appeal to white teenagers. As he understood the market, he tried appealing to that, and created some great records during the time. Unfortunately, though, he was like a lot of guys that recorded on King, like Roy Brown and Bull Moose Jackson, and, you know, on and on and on, people who were basically the architects of the rock and roll music that came up in the 1950s, were unable to find really a place within rock music for themselves. For various reasons. Usually they were a little on the old side by then. But so it's kind of an ironic situation that Wynonie Harris, in his success, by being something different, which, you know, like you said, he did strictly to, as he said, to make bread, to set himself apart from other singers, it created a new kind of music that he was no longer really all that welcome in.
Hmm. Well, to illustrate what you've just said, why don't we play Good Rockin' Tonight?
Okay.
Away all my blues. Have you heard the news? There's good rockin' tonight. Rock on, rock.
Wynonie Harris, good rocking tonight. What was the year?
It was 1948.
1948, wow. It sure sounds like rock and roll to me.
Yeah, to me too. And I think, you know, it's people make a big deal out of the fact that Good Rockin' Tonight was one of the very first songs that Elvis recorded for Sun Records in you know, 54, 55. But I think what that really shows is that growing up, Elvis Presley was a huge Wynonie Harris fan, and you know, he admitted later on that without Wynonie Harris, the Elvis Presley that we came to see on stage and hear on records would have been much, much different. So he consciously took a lot of Wynonie Harris in his makeup. And he wasn't alone. Those records, you know, from late 1940s, very early 1950s by Wynonie Harris and Tiny Bradshaw and folks like that on King were just gobbled up by the kids who would start making, you know, what were considered bona fide rock and roll records just a few years later.
Yeah. Well, there's a photograph of Wynonie Harris, at least one in the book, and he was so good looking.
Very handsome man, he was a good dancer, very, very, very charismatic performer. And, you know, I credit him in the book based on interviews and, you know, things I've read and just things that you can observe that, you know, he was a huge influence in terms of persona on everybody from Elvis to Little Richard to Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson was a big Wynonie Harris fan. Just of the sheer personality that Wynonie was able to put across. And he called himself Mr. Blues, and he was a very flashy guy.
Yeah. You pay tribute in this book, King of the Queen City, to the man who wrote Good Rockin' Tonight, Roy Brown.
Mm-hmm.
He also was a huge influence on artists, including James Brown.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about Roy Brown.
Roy was kind of a hard luck story in a lot of respects. He's one of those guys I mentioned earlier who, you know, built the house of rock and roll but then couldn't live in it. But Roy wrote that song, Good Rockin' Tonight, and thought it would be a perfect song for Wynonie Harris to record. So he approached Wynonie at a Wynonie Harris gig, offering him the song, I believe, for $50. And that was kind of the standard price for just selling a song outright at those days, which means Wynonie would have then owned the song and would have reaped the millions of dollars in copyright. But Wynonie told him to get lost, so... So Roy was desperate for money, so he wangled an invite to cut the song on Deluxe Records and did so and was rewarded with an instant hit. It really started climbing the charts down, I think probably starting outward from New Orleans, moving outward. And it came to Wynonie Harris's attention that the song he had turned down was on the way to being a big hit, so... He hustled into King, and because of the speed that I talked about that King was capable of doing, he had a record within a couple of days out on the market, and it eclipsed Roy Brown's version and became a big hit. But Roy did all right. He had a good career for Deluxe Records, which started out as a rival of King and then became owned by King and a subsidiary label of King. Roy had a lot of great records. He was one of the early great blues singers, just a huge voice, a big influence on both James Brown and B.B. King. And should have been, you know, if he weren't able to be a star in rock music, he should have been able to be a big star in blues as the 50s progressed, but he just sort of... The hits just quit coming for Roy Brown, and you know, he was fairly philosophical about it. He thought that he had just sort of run his course. He recognized that music was cyclical and that his cycle had ended. But Henry Glover always felt that if Roy had played guitar instead of just singing, if he'd been a singing guitar player like B.B. King, he would have been a huge star. But it was just sort of musical fashions just changed out from under him, and that kind of blues singing was, unless you were also a guitar player, was just kind of not the flavor of the day at the time. So he just kind of faded away.
Mm.
But he was a great one.
Yeah. Now, another musician that you write about in the book is Bill Doggett.
Mm-hmm.
Also an interesting guy in terms of, he was smart, I think, about making his bread. He knew how to put together a band.
Yeah.
Who was in his R&B band? What would you like to say about Doggett?
Well, I think his classic band was Doggett on organ, Billy Butler on guitar, Clifford Scott on saxophone, and then usually I think Edwin Conley, usually a bass and drum of usually King session guys, Edwin Conley, maybe Philip Paul. But the main threesome was Doggett, Butler, and Scott. And that threesome was just a powerhouse rhythm and blues band. And they worked probably in the 50s, they probably worked 300 nights a year.
Mm.
And then came up with a huge hit that kind of defined them, Honky Tonk, in 1956, which became the biggest record of the year, the biggest R&B record of the year, and probably the biggest R&B instrumental of the 50s. And it was interesting in that it developed out of just a jam at a gig. They were playing a dance in Lima, Ohio, and Billy Butler wanted to get the rest of the guys back on stage, so he just started playing this little blues jam on guitar. And as the players joined him one by one on stage, they just started following him, just playing along. And then they played it and went on to the next song. And a couple songs later, somebody came up to request the new song. And they realized that, oh, you're talking about that jam. So, okay, well, whatever. Played it again, and the crowd went wild. And they played it about 10 times more that night. The crowd went wild each time. But then Doggett had to fight Sid Nathan to put it on record because he wanted to do it as a two-sided single, and Sid said that would just cost too much money. So they had a big fight. And fortunately, Sid lost a lot of the fights that he had with the artists. And this came out as a two-sided single and was a huge hit.
Yeah, well, let's hear a bit of Honky Tonk. And now Doggett is on organ here,
yes.
But he's way in the background.
Yeah, he preferred to let Billy Butler on guitar and Clifford Scott on sax do the heavy lifting. He was just kind of the groove meister of the band.
Yeah, okay. Here's Honky Tonk.
We'll be right back.
Honky Tonk. That was the top R&B record of 1956, Bill Doggett. But you can understand why those dancers asked to have that one again.
Oh, yeah. It's a great timeless tune. It's been played at many dances and many parties down through the years.
Yeah. Well, we have to wrap up here. Quickly tell us what happened to King in the 60s, and pretty much by early 1970s, it was over for the label.
Yeah, well, Sid Nathan died in 1968, and he was King Records in the final analysis. And it was sold about 6 months after he died. It was sold and packaged together with Starday Records, which was a country label out of Nashville. And those two packages have stayed together since then and are now owned. They went through three or four different ownerships between 1968 and the present. They've been owned since, I guess, the 80s by a man in Nashville named Mo Lytle. Does business under various names, Gusto Records, King Records, International Marketing Group. So the masters, virtually everything that King recorded, except for James Brown, is owned there in Nashville by IMG.
Hmm. Well, John Fox, I want to thank you so much for sharing the story and sharing some music with us this afternoon. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, it was my pleasure, Celeste. Thank you for inviting me.
John Hartley Fox is the author of King of the Queen City, The Story of King Records. The book is published by the University of Illinois Press. And my thanks this afternoon to our Mike Pritchard for help with our playlist this afternoon here on the program.